Well, welcome to Future Library. It's another podcast, another week. For you, anyway, it's another week, listeners. For me, it's another podcast, another hour. This is my second of today, my fourth in 2 days. And by the end of this week, I'll have probably done about six or seven. So starting to feel kind of slightly like I'm trapped in this world of endless podcasts. I've got another one to do actually after this one. So, yeah, it's turning into a pod day. But for you, listeners, it's just another week, isn't it? So you don't want to hear my complaining about it. my guest this week is, because I may as well skip straight to the guest rather than some gibbering nonsense from myself. My guest this week is an artist from Bristol. He's called Dan Petley. He's unusual in that he approached us on the podcast, sent a message through Andy at Pet Piranha to me. So unlike normal podcasts where it's somebody who I've contacted and said, hey, come and talk to me on the podcast, Dan has come to us and said, can I come and talk on the podcast? And I've listened and looked to his stuff and said, yes, you can come and talk on the podcast. That's fine. Because the alternative would have been to say, no, fuck off. Which at some point, no doubt, somebody will approach me who I will think is totally shit. And I will say no, fuck off to them. But on this occasion, I haven't said no, fuck off. I've said, that's fine. So, Dan, normally I would be now saying, as you know, because you've heard the podcast before, I would normally be saying, I know a bit about you, but some of the listeners don't. But in this case, I don't know much about you either, so fill me in.
Wow, you know what? I didn't realise quite how unorthodox my introduction method was.
Well, you know, it's absolutely fine. It's I think this is something that, hopefully as the podcast kind of grows in listeners, hopefully this kind of thing will happen. And, you know, there will be an occasion where I will have to say to somebody who's come at me from some funk fusion band to fuck off, but until that day happens, I'm not going to worry about it.
Well, I'll tell you what, it'll be a glorious day when it does happen. You know, to have the authority to tell people to fuck off is a...
I might just be nice and not say anything. I might just, you know...
Oh.
Yeah. I try to be a nice... You know, I don't want to be a cunt, so... Yeah. You know, not all the time. Sometimes it's essential to be, but... this podcast is about being positive and you know...
Yeah,
so anyway, I'm digressing. Dan, tell us about yourself.
Okay. Basically, most of the work that I do, it's kind of in a kind of painting sort of format thing. I'm self-taught from the age of about 25. Oh, I'm going to be 35 in a few months' time. So I guess I've been painting for 10 years. But the whole concept of sort of teaching yourself something from scratch, working out you're quite good at it, and then trying to expand your own knowledge through the new skills that you learn is basically the process I've been through over the last decade. So through doing that, I've kind of pushed it into teaching other people to sort of brainwash themselves, for want of a better phrase, to take up painting and kind of use the previous skills they already have to reframe them into doing that. And I've had quite surprisingly good results, and that's, that's kind of the background of the sort of workshop stuff I do.
And you also do, I've got a whole bunch of things up on screen here. You do painting, you do cartoons, I've got some films listed here. Mm-hmm. I've got your band that's just over a year old, and I've got your street art. So which of those things would you like to tell me about first in more detail?
I suppose we could go straight into the titmice.
Yeah, tell me about the titmice. I had to listen to the titmice. I heard a song about shitty biscuits.
Oh, I love that song. Oh, yes, that's a beautiful piece. Basically, everything we do is improvised. Mm-hmm. There's three of us. We sit in a room and we just get it off our chest. We have a tape player. We press record and then we just play. And I always used to do it as a party piece. I used to just sit and on my own play songs and say, what would you like me to make a song about? And then, so with this band, we sort of started doing that, realized that we're coming up with some quite funny stuff. And then for some stupid reason, we decided to start playing gigs in local pubs. And for some reason, we didn't get kicked out and people actually liked it. Which, you know, I think we're still quite shocked about it ourselves now. But a lot of the songs that we improvise, like Shit Biscuits, we did a different version of that last time we played. Every time we play, Harry, who's our bassist, always really wants us to play songs that we've already, in inverted commas, perfected on tape.
Right.
Andrew's our sound person, our noise person. He basically just sits in the corner dribbling and playing with toys.
Right.
And that, yeah, that sort of it's quite an entertaining thing to watch. And yeah, it all kind of all meshes together. So yeah, sometimes we do things like open mics, and if you just sort of hit people with Shit Biscuits when they're not expecting, sometimes you can get a really nice response. Other times you get really angry people, and it's just the idea, I suppose, is just trying to reframe people's anger into borderline appreciation, which generally tends to fail. But in an entertaining way, I think.
Look at your website. It describes you as an improvisational collective. Mm-hmm. Composition satirized the troubling predicament of producing new music in this awkward phase of human evolution, a time when, due to the accessibility of media that was not present in the golden ages of pop and rock music, new young bands suffer an overwhelming, troubling obligation to reference and understand the 70 years of popular music that has preceded them. Do you think that's actually true?
I think when you go and see bands, we sort of live in a really easy era of music production. I'm not saying that being in a band and being a talented musician is an easy thing to do. It's just that when you think of the struggle that bands would have gone through in the 70s or 80s, having to sort of develop the income and make this thing, the amount of money it would cost for somebody to go and press a vinyl or to get involved with a record company, the amount of corporate record company and music industry bullshit that people had to deal with back then, that's not really part of it anymore. Everybody has this freedom to do whatever they want and pretty much disseminate it to whichever audience they deem appropriate. I think we're very free and lucky, and I think that maybe makes music a bit of a lazier thing. I've got this bizarre obsession with like New Album, early 80s British heavy metal. I think some of the music that came out of that era is ridiculous, but so beautiful because of the amount of struggle that went into getting this stuff to some kind of level where people would know that these people exist. And I don't know. I feel like I'm probably waffling here.
Well, do you think that, I mean, I agree with you that there's the ability to make music has become far easier, the ability to create it on computers and get it out to people is far, far easier. But I'm kind of curious about this sense that you think there may be an obligation by bands to reference and understand 70 years of popular music. Do you think that some young band who are trying to sound like maybe the Foo Fighters are thinking in the back of their minds about 20s music?
I think that the obligation comes more from the fact that you can't really discover anything new in the circumstances that we have, because everything is so accessible. You can easily, without buying a record, just go onto YouTube and search anything from the last 70 years. In fact, that's what I mean by obliged. I think people have an obligation that they should try and explore as much of the rich and varied heritage of music as they can. I mean, it's not a difficult thing to do anymore.
So do you think that it's less that they have that they're kind of forced to? Do you feel that, so you're saying you think they should be doing this rather than...
Yeah. I think the obligation is more, you know, I'm sort of looking at it as in my snobbish sort of like, oh, I know lots about music sort of thing. And I feel like it's... In order to respect somebody that plays music, you kind of expect them to have done a bit of exploration and a bit of thinking and a bit of obsessive collecting as well. Because I think that's a really important part of music.
You see, I kind of... I'm in two minds about that, because I used to think a similar thing, that, you know, you had to have a certain understanding of things. But as I've got older, I mean, I'm now 41. As I've got older, I'm kind of becoming more, I don't know, really, it's kind of more of the opinion that maybe it's less important, that, you know, that music can be created in a vacuum.
Okay.
And that people maybe shouldn't be referencing the past at all if they can avoid it, because if we reference the past too much, then all we're going to do is just steal from it and repeat it. Whereas if we are not concerned about that and just creating using the tools we have now available, then maybe... I don't know.
From the sort of standpoint of Pop Will Eat itself, I mean, where do you stand then? Do you feel that you're trying to put yourself in a vacuum, or you want to be in a vacuum?
No, I think if somebody's in a vacuum, then I don't think they have any obligation to remove themselves from that vacuum. I think it's difficult to be in a vacuum.
It's very hard. It's a challenge to sort of avoid listening or being influenced by anything. It's very hard. I feel like we are sponges and we kind of absorb everything. Yeah, you'd have to live on a desert island, surely.
Well, yeah. But I still think, in the same time, I don't think there's an obligation there from the...
I see.
Do you understand where I'm coming from?
I think
the band shouldn't have to feel that to be worthy of attention, that they should have, you know, understood and absorbed 70 years worth of music. You know, if they are only interested in playing three-minute pop punk songs that's going to reference their immediate predecessors, then, you know, say... I would say that, like, my youngest son plays drums and guitar in various bands, and they kind of play pop punk stuff. And the earliest they've kind of gone back in reference is people like Husker Du and Dinosaur Jr. And that's as far back as they feel they need to go. And I think, you know, I think beyond that, there's not much that they could take from the bands that influenced those bands, because the influences of those bands are a step away from what they're doing now. So they're a step too far back. So, you know, like somebody like Husker Du may have been influenced a little bit by people like Black Flag and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And kind of people like the Misfits and stuff. But the young bands don't need to go back beyond the certain point where the music is so different from what they're doing. They need to go back to kind of the originator of what they're doing if they want to understand a certain form. But they don't even need to do it.
In doing that, they're sort of... although they're not actively looking for where the influences came from, they're still going in, aren't they?
Yeah, I think if you're interested in music, I think it's good that the availability is there. I think that really helps. So, I think
you're right about the obligation thing. I think for maybe the phrase that kind of is laying our cards on the table as musical snobs. I think basically, you're quite right. That statement basically it's the tip my saying we are musical snobs, and we kind of feel maybe obligation is the wrong word. Maybe we feel slaves to the last 70 years of music.
So do you feel that because of your sense of how music kind of sits heavily on you, maybe, that you feel that there's this sense that you're pulled by it, that it's almost like this kind of ever-growing mass of stuff around your legs that you're trying to wade through?
Maybe. Yeah, I feel... actually, a lot of the time when I talk to our bassist, Harry, he kind of feels... He does feel swamped by this... Again, it's the word obligation to sort of go up there and play well and have good songs. I mean, he was saying, I think we should play more sensible songs. And I said, yeah, you need to have a side band to do that, because, you know, I don't think the Titmice can be a sensible musical entity. We have to just be officially humorous, I think.
Yeah, and nor should you have to be sensible. I mean, that's the thing. There's plenty of space for what would almost be classed as kind of outsider music. Now, outsider music in its general... the way it's generally conceptualized is music that's made by people who are completely unaware. So you're people that, you know, have maybe people who could have either have developed in complete isolation, having no understanding of what actual music is, or who have got mental illnesses or whatever, or have something that's preventing them from fully engaging at the level of understanding that we just take for granted. Yeah. So I think if you're, from what I've heard of the Titmice, is that it's it has the impression of outsider music in that it's in the nature of the improvisation, and that you're allowing a certain kind of almost kind of musical naivety to inform what you're doing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you've got this sense of kind of understanding of it. So it's almost like a faux outsider music.
It's a faux outsiderness. But then again, I think the thing that we struggle with as musicians playing music is the fact that all we have is the ability that we have, and we can't really get any better. And I think as creative people, we do feel at fault, and thus the surprise of people really engaging with what we do and enjoying it. Sometimes we do feel like such fakes, but if we started to work hard trying to be good, immediately people wouldn't appreciate it anymore.
Ah, but you see, the thing is, being aware that you sometimes feel that you're fakes, being aware of that is maybe makes it okay.
I see.
Because there's an understanding there. It's like what happened with me when I was at art college. I kind of got very heavily into conceptual art when I was at art college, and decided that pretty much either everything was art or nothing was art, depending on how you defined it. And that the realization of that meant you didn't even have to define it for it to either be art or not art. So everything became kind of this Schrodinger's art. So it was either art, everything was art, or nothing was art, or everything was both simultaneously. At which point I then stopped creating work and left university shortly after I was asked to, due to not going to any lectures for a while. But it's maybe the realization makes it okay that, you know, you can go, okay, we are, there's a certain amount of artifice to what we're doing. We are allowing ourselves, we are playing within a limited abilities, and we are using improvised music as our way of expressing ourselves, and that further throws up, you know, the risk. Because, I mean, often improvisers, in some cases, are kind of real kind of virtuosos. The improvisers in the areas that I move in tend to be people who are kind of fairly keen amateurs, but who've got a good keen ear for listening to what the other members of the bands are doing, which is the most important thing, I think, with improvising. So I think, there's a... Yeah, I don't know how it would fit. I think it seems to me that you've got this kind of uneasy or kind of interesting tension between awareness of the past and a kind of willful desire to do something that might be difficult and that you're kind of wanting to be difficult, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know, we feel that by not being part of this movement that's already happened, like the punk movement, you could argue that in the 70s the punk movement sort of was only the punk movement until the first bands got signed. Then it became faux in that way, but probably in a bad way, because it didn't have the self-awareness of it being a parody of itself. And that's why you sort of get the kind of more interesting alternative bands happening after, you know, the big cheesy heavy metal bands get really big. You get sort of the grunge movement coming in, which I suppose has the self-awareness and the knowledge of the past, but not to an extent that it ruins the spirit of being a rebellious entity.
Yeah, it's when bands kind of fall in it's maybe when they could have fallen in the gaps between movements of, you know, think before the press kind of swoops in and makes something popular. You know, after punk, you had the new wave stuff in the UK, and that maybe was kind of a more interesting time because you had more awkward sounding bands coming out of that who were, you know, late 70s, early 80s that were, you know, like far more politicized and less about the nihilism of punk.
Yeah.
And less about the kind of no future thing. Maybe, you know, they were more politicized, more understanding how trade unions worked and how politics worked, and were interested and wanted to engage with those things instead of taking this kind of blank slate kind of disinterest that people like the Sex Pistols portrayed rather than maybe actually thought. So I think it's those little spaces where things fall in the gaps that maybe the interesting stuff happens. But then it all gets commodified.
The Wobbum.
Yeah, so, you know, it's a...
No Wobbum.
Yeah. So, okay, so we've covered... I think we should...
I think it's been like a musical counselling session.
Hopefully.
I think we've made a lot of progress.
Hopefully I've helped. So, tell us a bit about your well, I mean, you're in Bristol, obviously.
Yeah.
Bristol has famously got a very... it's got a very supportive attitude towards street art.
It does, although that's sort of become quite interesting in recent times with where my old studio was. It's become sort of a gentrified area. It's become a place where a lot of middle-class people have moved in and have started to kind of make street art rather than sort of as a expression against the world or an expression of themselves. It's become a more contrived thing where people are trying to make work that does fit into this sort of superficial category of street art. I mean, yeah, this is all heavily my own bad attitude opinion.
But do you think that's, again, similar to what we were just discussing, that maybe the dropping through the cracks point has finished? Now it's become kind of accepted by the local council and the kind of authorities almost, that the wankers then sweep in.
Yes, yes. And the way I feel that my relationship with Bristol has been is kind of coming here maybe potentially... I could have become one of the wankers if I hadn't sort of stayed true to the program of thinking that I'd gone through in the place where I lived before, which was Plymouth, where it was a lot harder to actually find any kind of connection to the outside world. People don't really pay artists to do anything. And one of the reasons I came to Bristol was because there'd be other artists that I could work with and work out how I can carry on making work without feeling like I was becoming one of the wankers, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing, isn't it? I mean, it's if you move to a place where the hipsters dwell, then there's the risk of becoming the hipster.
Yes.
I think that's a difficult one to address because you only realise you've become a hipster when somebody else who then moves there goes, oh, you fucking hipster.
Yes.
And then you look in the mirror and you go, oh my God.
Yes.
It's happened. And then either at that point you fully despair or you go, so what? And you go and have, I don't know, what they call them, a dirty burger at a pop-up burger shop called Pirate Pete's Burger Shop. And you go there, you know, in your little kind of turned-up trousers and your little kind of deck shoes and your ironic facial hair and sailor tattoos and just sink into it and just become a hipster for life. So it's, I guess it's the point where you kind of either take the step back from hipsterism or... absorb yourself into it fully, become part of the hive mind of hipsters.
Or you sort of evolve your own, well, you know, much as I hate the word hipster, your own kind of hipster cult, I think, in order to keep face when you're making artwork, you have to have some kind of understanding of where you stand in that process. Yeah, the self-awareness. But then again, you don't want to deliver what the hipsters want.
Yeah. I should point out very quickly that if anybody can hear a kind of rumbling sound in the background at my end, that's the cat sitting on my lap.
I just have a dog waddled in a while ago.
Well, the thing is, if you then make your own kind of semi kind of autonomous hipster cult, have you actually gone full hipster at that point?
I really don't know. Because I feel like maybe I've spent the last three, because I've been in Bristol for 3 years, and I feel like a lot of what I've achieved, in inverted commas, was kind of done in isolation. I never really joined any kind of group. And so I think when I got to a point where I felt comfortable with what I was doing, I've not been comfortable in what I'm doing in that I've managed to make a huge amount of profit from what I do, mm-hmm. aside from reframing it into doing workshops. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the issues with starting up workshops is there were a lot of people in Stokes Croft where I started working, and I don't have a studio there because I can't anymore because I can't really afford it. Mm-hmm. So I felt as though there were a lot of people there that were doing street art tours and things to do with street art from a very middle class perspective,
yeah.
of selling it and turning it into a product.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that a little bit awkward, really. So my way of doing things has been trying to involve myself with educational establishments and then focus more on the method of teaching that I'd mm-hmm. come up with. And that method of teaching is what I'd inflicted upon myself through the first, 7 years of my practice.
Mm-hmm.
And, I started trying to use that for other people that I was working with.
Actually, that would, going and teaching people is the kind of thing that will cause the hipsters to go, So maybe that has helped you fight the hipster.
Yeah, I reckon so. Yeah, it's fought my inner hipster.
Yeah, you've avoided going full hipster by taking that step into education, which is really, it's the opposite of the hipster. I can't imagine a hipster going, I think I'll go and teach people how to do this or that, because that involves a certain level of kind of planning and and foresight and thinking about things that I think
and
maybe
engagement. Yeah. I think. Yeah,
you can't be sneeringly detached if you're trying to teach people how to do something. So that's probably how you've done it. So the trick is to walk the line and not fall off either side.
Yeah, so that makes some kind of sense. This is very much like a counselling session. I feel like we've touched upon my musical demons.
And, this is what people, you never know what to expect with episodes of this podcast, because sometimes it'd be a nice kind of like kind of chat, and sometimes maybe it'll be kind of like something a bit more challenging, and something a bit more kind of there's not been anything confrontational yet, which is a good thing. But maybe at some point in the future, if I keep doing it, I'm sure that there will be at some point an episode where I'll sit having a proper conflict with somebody and saying, well, I think what you do is shit, and this is why, but I think this is good, this part, but I don't know what you're thinking here. I want to very briefly touch on some of the movies. Now, the one that really leapt out at me was actually Helping Art.
God, that's a very old piece. Yeah.
I liked the fact that it was for a fictional company, that you've made this kind of corporate video that's kind of done in a very po-faced, very straight-faced way, and done exactly like a corporate video for a very small-level local business would be done, for a business that doesn't exist.
Every person that took part in that film believed it to be true.
You see, that's even better, isn't it? Because
it was beautiful. I was so pleased with how that came out, and interviewing people as well, because it was obviously while I was still studying. So I invented this company, and I came up with a cheesy logo for it. And I was working for a lot of people. It was when I was first working in schools, actually, mm-hmm. and doing sort of lead artist projects. And so a lot of the people that I tried to use in the film, I was also working for them. Right. And so it was like holding up a mirror, but at the same time, and after that, I had to be quite respectful to the people that I'd used.
Yeah,
but I realised that I didn't have to make any apologies, because people didn't realise. They still believed it to be exactly what I said it was. Nice. Which it doesn't. If you watch the film, it doesn't actually say that Helping Art does anything. It's just a thing. It's just a brand. That's all it is.
And it just talks about it's presented in such a way that it has that Yeah, absolutely right. It has that kind of vacuous nothingness at its core that all of these things have.
Yeah.
But they, you know, they always sound like there should be something there that should be meaningful in some way or shape or form. And then they're not necessarily that. And it's, I think that, I liked that. And was part of that, do you feel like a certain kind of animosity towards the art establishment?
The only animosity I really have to it is the fact that you can't really have an art establishment that is inclusive at the same time as having an art establishment that focuses on quality. However, if you have an art establishment that only cares about quality, it stops caring about people. And so the whole idea of helping out was that it would be this faux company that had, if you, you know, on paper, you'd think, oh, okay, that's it's sort of covering all bases in a very sort of democratic sort of way. But really, it is just shit.
Yeah.
And so in order to have good art, you need to have these difficult organizations that you have to communicate with and kind of align yourself with. And I think that's one of the traumas that I was trying to meditate on, I suppose, by, making a pretend company.
It's a difficult thing, isn't it? Because the art establishment is, if you're not part of it, they appear to be a massive pile of wankers who are setting themselves up as self-appointed gatekeepers, preventing certain people into the party and telling other people what is and isn't art. But then on the other side, if you just open the doors and let everybody in, there's going to be a lot of shit watercolours of fields done by people who can't paint.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's...
I tell you what, I really miss seeing... sort of bad painters making watercolours of fields. There was a project I did in Plymouth where I created this character called Josh Valley, who was just some guy that had taught himself painting through reading Rolf Harris books.
Right.
And he'd paint pictures of kittens and puppies. Those paintings, there was a bidding war for one of those paintings. People loved them. It's really odd. You sort of get into this thing, you explore it, and you do have to kind of always sort of keep stepping back and saying, I'm doing this as an experiment because it's interesting. Because I could have just become a kitten and puppy painter, although I think people would have got bored of that very quickly.
But the thing is that there's an audience for that kind of work, and I think that's the other thing is what makes the... art establishment, again in inverted commas, kind of seems sneery, is that they have a kind of sneery attitude towards what the public like. You know, it's art for the public, and it's a difficult line to walk, because on one hand they're right, a lot of it is shit and horrible, but on the other hand, who are they to say that what the public likes is wrong? It's like the way that people will attack the X Factor and things like that, and will say, "Oh, it's the catch of the penis of music, and this is the worst thing that's ever existed." But at the same time, people like it. Now, who are we to say that those people are wrong for liking it? But at the same time, who are we to say that they're right for liking it? I mean, maybe if they're exposed to something better, they would like that as well. But who's to say that they would? Maybe they'd just go, oh, what's this Ponzi shit? And would, you know, put on Leonor Lewis or whatever her name is again. Put on One Direction. I want to hear One Direction again. And, you know, it's...
I think the whole X Factor culture has infested itself in the sort of hipster elite society of Bristol. I think... as a street painter, there's so many people that set up competitions to decide who paints their pub or who paints a big mural. And I don't think things like that should be done by competitions. It should be done by people thinking, I want somebody to do this painting, so I'm going to approach them. it almost, by turning it into a competition, I think it kind of shows a lack of respect to the people that work really hard in order to do an application to that sort of competition, if you see what I mean.
But then on the other hand, by maybe doing the competition, are they maybe opening the gates a little bit wider to allow people in who maybe wouldn't have had a look in if it was just through the standard gatekeepers and the standard establishment? Because if you're saying to somebody...
If a competition like that was sort of, did sort of expose somebody that had no exposure in the first place, then I'd say definitely yes. But in the real world, that doesn't happen.
No. Well, I think unfortunately what happens in the real world is that somebody will win it, and it may be somebody who's an unknown, but it won't actually open any doors for them because they're still not part of the establishment. It won't get them into the establishment.
Yeah.
They'll win a prize. People will look at them and go, oh, that's interesting. They won a pub prize. And that's the end of that for them. And they will kind of have this impression, like X Factor winners, that, you know, this is easy street from now on. They are now part of the party. And they're still sneered at and still looked at as being not part of the party. So it's a really difficult thing. It's a difficult thing to work out which way to go with it. Because on one hand, you want people to feel included. On the other hand, some people just can't be because they're not very good. But then on the other hand, on the third hand, which is on some kind of third arm sticking out from somewhere, you know, who are we to say that they're not very good? I mean, apart from people with eyes who can tell something that isn't very good. So and then on the fourth hand, which is coming out from another part of my body, up to four hands now, maybe that's wrong. And it's, you know, you almost just reach the point where you just say, fuck it, I'm just not going to be involved.
I think once you do sort of get appreciated, you have to work very hard to, you know, keep going. And I think if somebody's got to go through the whole situation of painting a pub, they've generally got to be somebody that's able to get away with doing that. So I don't know. I feel that there aren't really any lazy street painters that do well.
Could they be, though, on the other hand, this is the fifth hand now,
okay,
on the fifth hand, could they be the kind of people who deserve to be painting a pub?
They definitely deserve to be painting the railways, which, of course, anyone can do. You don't need to apply to graph something up. You don't need to apply to just go into the street and paint whatever you want to paint.
Yeah.
And I think that's what people need to do. They need to stop getting brainwashed by this idea that you need to be accepted by people and say, I've got this badge saying that I've
just as artist
won
on
a competition.
Yeah.
Because it just takes everything away from what it's about. But then again, I have no idea what it is about.
And that's the problem, isn't it? It's so difficult to actually work out what it's about that we may as well be just flailing around hopelessly trying to understand, you know, alien algebra or something. Because it's ultimately there's no way of understanding what is going on because everybody approaches it differently, everybody thinks differently about it, and it's very difficult to kind of reach any kind of consensus with it. I'm very aware that time is ticking away, and before we draw things to a close, I want tell me about anything you've got coming up and where people should go online to find your work.
My street art person is called Old Master, which is me, but I mean, he's called Old Master because he uses Baroque and Renaissance imagery. But the first place to go really is danpetley.co.uk, which has got stuff about my workshops. I was thinking of killing off Old Master, actually. I can't work out whether he's sort of become a heavy cross to bear, or maybe Dan Petley's become a heavy cross to bear. Maybe I should kill him off and just become Old Master.
But what about just could become New Amateur?
New Amateur.
Yeah.
Titmouse. Maybe I should just put my entire website onto the Titmice website and be done with it.
Yeah, that could
work. It may kind of belittle some of the highbrow shit that I've done.
You see, this is I kind of feel that has this podcast accidentally pushed Dan Petley into a new direction? has it actually raised more questions for Dan Petley than it has for...
Oh, God. There always has to be questions. Yeah, you always have to be slightly confused about where you're going. You can't say, this is what I do, and then just do it and just not listen to anybody else. I mean, my girlfriend always says that I'm a very bad person for always wanting to ask other people what they think, because I'm genuinely interested in what other people think. So, yeah, I think it's quite typical that whenever I'm interviewed, it does sort of, it can be like a counselling session where by me actually speaking about what I do, it's kind of, yeah, it kind of helps me to reflect on it.
Excellent.
Which is really nice. I love doing it.
It's been
useful for me.
It's been a slightly different podcast from usual because it's been a bit more kind of, there's been more questioning and seeking, I think. But I think that's been good.
Nice.
So, unfortunately, as I say, time has caught up with us and we do have to draw things to a close. So do go to danpetley.co.uk to look at Dan's work. He has got a lot of things going on there and a lot of it's very well worth looking at. And... yeah, I mean, I'll put a link to that in the details about the podcast. So, yeah, is there anything you would like to add before we finish the show, Dan?
I have no idea what the point in seeing the titmice is, but don't get your hopes up too high if you do see them. And please don't hit us.
Approach with low expectations, but expect to be surprised, maybe.
Oh, that's perfect.
There you go. There you can have
that's a new slogan for us there.
Excellent.
That's perfect.
Excellent. Well, it's been a pleasure speaking to you, Dan.
Thanks, Alex.
I hope things continue to go well.
Yeah.
And as somebody who's come to us from being a listener to the podcast, you'll be listening to yourself in a few weeks' time, which would be peculiar, I should imagine.
Yeah.
Okay, well, all that's left to say then, and you know what's coming next, is a future library. Goodbye. Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Future Library. Future Library is brought to you by PetPiranha.com and is hosted by myself, Alex Bottom. The podcast is free, but if you do want to show your appreciation, feel free to go along to alexbottom.co.uk and click through to music, where you'll be able to find things that you can buy, or go to asmallglassghost.co.uk where you can buy my latest music. Episodes come out when I feel like it, mostly weekly. But that's it, so thank you for listening. Thank you.